Welcome. Today is the 9th of September, 2008. And just briefly, we were very privileged to meet our new friend, Marcus Shmika, who was here a few days ago for a few days. And he's the Vastu or Vasati expert. And I can say unequivocally that everyone was blown away by the knowledge shared. The responses were more than exuberant. Apparently, he enjoyed himself here. With my cooking, how could he not? He's coming back. We've already scheduled it for the 24th of November for a few days. He'll give another talk again, but the talk will not be the same. It'll be a different aspect or dimension of the Sati. So those who attended, I don't think would be bored anyway, but he's going to offer more practical tools, is what he said. And then he'll take bookings. We'll go ahead and book people anytime you want now, if you want him to go to your house or work on plans for a new building that you might have. So, just so you know that, 24th November.
Did you do that, or have you done that already?
Well, we kind of were in this very fortunate position. We did not ask him to do the house.
Mm-hmm.
We never asked.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing we asked him to do, we will pay for. He's doing working on some plans for us.
Mm-hmm.
But he offered.
The last 15 minutes, I can hear.
The last 15 minutes. Now, yeah, but Clindy had already drawn out the house.
Yeah.
It's already been mapped out.
Mm-hmm.
And you need plans, or you need some kind of a drawing.
Mm-hmm.
Also. And he said the following. He said, this house is almost perfect, Vastu. That's what he said. And then he assigned some of the yantras. The yantras are here. They're for sale. So we're sort of just repping him on behalf of that. There is not a full set of yantras here. You don't necessarily need a full set of yantras. You need certain specific ones. How do you know which ones you need without having somebody vasu your house? The best way to do it, in my opinion, is to go through his book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, look at your house, map out your house, to draw some sort of a diagram in relation to the directions. And your house, you draw your house, and then you divide it into 9 equal parts. Right? And then you have the 4 major directions, the 4 sub-directions, like, you know, northeast, southwest, and then the Brahmastan in the middle. Brahmastan is the place of Brahma, where the gods live, which should be empty. So you figure out what doesn't work according to the way things are supposed to be. And then you should be able to figure out what yantras you need. You don't necessarily need them all.
Whereabouts is the area that the gods live?
Right in the middle.
The very
middle of the house. And the very middle of each room.
Oh.
Microcosm, macrocosm. Right. So, in a perfect world, the very middle of each room is like this room. Empty. Clear. Which isn't always possible. Yeah, especially the big,
yeah.
Big bed. So you do the best you can, you know. And if you find a room that has a lot of defects, then that's when you want to put up a yantra.
Are Are there yantras that can be just used, even one, just to lift a barrier from the house? For example, my mother can't sell her house at the moment.
Yeah. Well, then you should probably get a Sri Yantra and put it in the northeast of the house.
Sri Yantra, northeast of the house.
Okay. Or, do you know what which direction the front door faces?
It faces southwest.
Southwest?
If I'm right.
Yeah, you heard what he said about southwest the other night?
Yeah. I'm nearly sure.
That's like the worst possible direction that your front door could face.
Build a wall.
So then you'd want to have a Sri Yantra above the front door on the inside of the door. You use a Sri Yantra above the front door when there are so many defects in the house that you can't even begin to deal with them all.
That's probably this, you know, there's some great things about the house, actually. But there are a lot of defects, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. That's the more
any depression or despondency?
No, not really, no.
No one has that. Any disease?
No, thank God, no. No, no. There's a lot of good music that's written there by me. A lot of, you know, people who were there studying did well in school. You know, a lot of good family stuff.
Well, are you sure it's southwest?
I need to double check that. Just
yeah, you need to get a
that's
compass.
What I meant to ask is the front door thing is it's when you have your back to the door.
And that's when you have, you know, it's when you're looking from the door outward.
Yeah, from the door outward, yeah. And not when you're standing facing the front door with your back to the door, effectively, yeah.
You're back to the door looking, yeah.
Looking
okay, I see what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I'll double check.
Okay. In the sky, Jupiter went direct yesterday. And Jupiter has been retrograde for some 4 months. So if you're having any problems with money and money being tight or difficult, or it needs to shake loose somehow, or you can't get the loan, or you can't get the mortgage, or you're waiting for somebody to pay you back, or I don't know, make your list, things should loosen up. Now, I'd like to say that it applies to everybody, but we all know that it doesn't. But it would certainly apply to many people. So Jupiter is money.
American stock market just had a record-breaking day yesterday.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
There you go. Jupiter went direct.
And when does this, when did this planetary change happen?
Oh, yesterday.
Monday, yeah.
Okay. Well, I was going to look at Goddess Parvati, attracting the man of your dreams. You know, it's one of those Drew Lawrence articles, 18 pages.
Clearly for women only.
No, it's actually got a few interesting bits in it. So
just reverse the whole thing.
Okay, do it backwards.
We will not get through it all. I might do maybe part today and then part next time. Now, I make no apologies for young Alex. I'm sure he can handle this kind of material. It has a spiritual focus. So Shiva is a manifestation of the three aspects of the Godhead in the material world. Shiva is God. Pretty much. If Vishnu is God and they compare Vishnu to milk, then Shiva is part of the Godhead as yogurt. Yogurt is produced from milk, but it isn't milk. It's a form of. So that's the concept of Shiva. But we shouldn't think that he's not a very, very high being. He is. But Shiva, one of his concerns is that Brahma creates, as we know, Vishnu maintains here in the material world, and Shiva destroys. Somebody has to bring things to an end and start the whole cycle over again. This is the usual thing, as we see now as we look at the trees beginning to turn. So Shiva is a yogi, and mostly what you see, he's sitting around doing yoga and meditation, because that's what he likes to do. And he lives up in the Himalayas, or Himalayas. Himalaya is actually the correct pronunciation. And up on Mount Kailas. Has anybody been to Mount Kailas in Nepal? Clindy, you've been there, haven't you? Near there? That's where he lives.
We had to run off it because this major lightning storm came in and sort of hitting the ground right on top of us. No way. Let's get out of here.
So,
someone didn't ask permission to climb the mountain.
Yeah, you gotta ask permission. That's one thing they don't do because they're too busy conquering nature. Mm. Bad approach. Not good idea. So, people or persons who undergo long-term penance and austerity can win Shiva's favor. Or Brahma's favor, or Vishnu's favor. And such a person was a powerful demon chieftain named Taraka, who wanted to achieve some degree of immortality. So he did his penances. When Shiva then finally offered him a boon or a blessing, he asked, because he couldn't really get immortality, it's the mortal world. What he asked for was that only a son born to Shiva would be able to kill him. And Taraka's reasoning was, this guy's a yogi, you know. He doesn't have a woman. He's not even interested in that kind of stuff. He's busy meditating all day. He's not going to have a son. So if he doesn't produce a son, well, I'm in the clear. So that was his plan. So what do you suppose Shiva told him? He said, okay, I agree. You can have this boon. So he, receiving his boon, Taraka went about decisively defeating the gods and seizing their heavenly domain. He took over and the higher planetary systems. So now he was in charge. He removed Indra, the king of the gods. Indra's domain is, what is Indra in charge of?
Rain.
Thunder and rain and
lightning.
He's like Thor.
So is this Indra's fault? If you chant to Indra, will she stop raining?
Well, according to Jan, you chant to the sun god and he comes out. That works better. Yeah, so if you chant to the rain god, you just might get more rain around here. I'm not so sure, but the rain god is very active in this country, as we all know. More so this month than ever before. More so this year. So I would go with Jan. I would go with the sun god.
Yeah, every time she turns up here, the sun comes out.
And then we get back here and it's a lashing.
Yeah. Yeah, they went on a horse's day in the lashing rain, so I don't know.
Come hang out with me. Sorry, I suppose Jan. I mean Jan.
So, since Shiva himself was a yogi or celibate ascetic, the gods had to find a woman or a goddess capable of luring Shiva into marriage or even a sexual encounter in order to produce the child who would kill the demon, Taraka. Right. Enter Parvati. Parvati is born to Himavat, the god of the Himalayas, and his wife Mena. Parvati means mountain goddess. She's usually described as being dark, and in some versions is given the name Kali, the dark one, because of her complexion. She's also described as being very beautiful. In some accounts, she shows a keen interest in Shiva from the outset, repeating his name to herself. and taking great delight in hearing about his appearance and his deeds, his legend. As a child, a sage comes to her home and, after examining the marks on her body, predicts that she will marry a naked yogi. Well, who's that? Shiva. He's got some clothing on. He's not totally naked. Examining the marks on the body is known as the science of Samudraka. You looked at that book we have here. Or bodily markings. Samudra means ocean. So the science of bodily markings, Samudraka, is an ocean of knowledge. You have to know what every mark on the body means. They can all be read. Lines in the forehead, of course, the famous lines in the palm, lines on the feet. You didn't know, they count too. Moles, signs of moleology. There's moleology. Yeah. So these are primarily the lines upon the palms, the bottom of the feet, as well as facial features and marks, such as lines and moles. When it became clear that she was destined to marry Shiva, her parents were very honored. Parvati was delighted and sometimes had glimpses of her past life as Sati, again, the wife of Shiva. So they were busy reincarnating to be together. Humans do that too sometimes. Not quite on the wavelength of these two, but... In the modern day, the British model, Kate Moss, is an example of a woman born with a mole on her right breast, which is indicative of fame and success, as a matter of fact. Although she does not have the traditional form... Ladies, curb your enthusiasm. Although she does not have the traditional form or body of a model, she has been a highly successful supermodel for years, which is an interesting statement. Mm. Even when she was involved in a scandal around drugs, she managed to transcend this infamy and to reestablish her stellar career. She did. She got all of her contracts back that she had lost and more. Hmm? The old mole on the right breast trick.
Get the marker, actually.
That's not the same.
I'm going to be huge.
I think they call that a condition. A woman may also be blessed with the marks of the Godhead, all of which have been delineated in the Vedic literatures. For example, there was a princess named Damayanti in ancient times whose beauty was unsurpassed and unparalleled. And so much so that a few of the gods came down from the heavenly realms seeking her hand in marriage. She was human, but she was so beautiful that a few of the gods came down to vie for her hand. Are you making statements over there? Is that what's going on?
I'm just trying to figure out where
they intend to stay with us. They're okay with that.
Are they?
Oh, yeah. They can handle all that. Because they can go back whenever they like, you know.
They got to have human pressures.
They do. My dear, if you want that, you must go to the heavenly planets and you will have more pleasures than you can dream, 10,000 times more satisfying than they are here. Guaranteed. They're available to you. But when you exhaust your pious credits, your merits, down you come again.
Snakes and ladders.
Snakes and ladders. So Damayanti possessed a birthmark of a lotus flower described to be like a faint freckle. right here, between her eyebrows. At present, there is a woman known to me who is an evolved soul coming from a very wealthy family who carries the birthmark of a conch shell on the inside of her left arm, which is also sometimes recognized as a sign of divine favor. Parvati is persistent in her quest to win Shiva as her husband, and she sets out to perform austerities, penances, privations. One of the most effective means of fulfillment of any desire or wish is the performance of tapas, or penance, austerity, or voluntary sacrifice, which is what we were talking about earlier. Through persistent performance of austerity, one will generate so much heat, which is tantamount to determination, force of will, or fire of desire, that the gods will be obligated to grant the ascetic a wish in order to save themselves and the world from being scorched by the heat, by that heat. That's what happens, you generate heat, fire. It is interesting to compare the modern version of penance to win over a man and gain a relationship. To wit, it generally consists of diet and fasting, weight loss if necessary, physical workouts and exercise, hair removal and waxing, manicure and pedicure, tanning beds or liquid tan, facial mask, hair coloring and styling, perhaps Botox injections or plastic surgery, breast augmentation and various other beauty treatments, and austerities. The modern day penance, ladies. Surely you've heard of it. By undergoing penance and privation, Parvati is demonstrating to Shiva that she can match him in his own realm. Right? Oftentimes women want to draw a man in to their realm. How many times do they actually want to go to his realm? Or they want to sort of ensnare him and make him think that they're going to his realm. Then once they get him, they don't really want to go to his realm. Exactly. So Parvati knew that she'd have to go to his realm because this is Shiva. That she has the inner resource, self-control, and fortitude to cut herself off from the world and completely master her physical needs and her physical urges. By performing tapas, Parvati abandons the world of the householder and enters the world of the renouncer, Shiva's world. Her austerities surpass that of even the great sages of her time. She performs the traditional mortifications such as sitting in the midst of four fires in the middle of summer. They establish four fires and they sit in the middle at the heat. That's one of their old standby ones. Remaining exposed to the elements during the rainy season and winter, living on leaves or air alone. Standing on one leg for years, etc. Eventually, she generates so much heat that the gods are made uncomfortable. They go to Shiva to persuade him to grant Parvati's wish so that she will end her austerities. Shiva, hearing, you know, the whole story here with Parvati, agrees to marry her. Women generally fail to understand or to realize their inherent ability to attract a man into their life. There's no particular need to physically go here or there, bars included, in order to find a man. The personal magnetism of the feminine energy has the ability to draw things to itself, much like the moon, which attracts or draws the tides. Is a moon not the symbol for a woman? Timing is a consideration, however, and there are some times that are better than others. That's where Vedic astrology comes in, because we can find out those times, for example. She must have the power of determination and focus, and she must also be willing not to settle for something less than her envisioned ideal. You can settle for less, but what happens when you settle for less? You get less, and you become dissatisfied. And you would you say get comfortable? Yeah, complacent, I think, is the word. Yeah. So, exactly. Also, she must qualify herself as a worthy receptacle for that particular man, so that she will have the power and ability to contain his energy. A woman is a container, isn't she? She has to contain the man. As Parvati eventually attracted the unattractable and uncontainable Shiva, a woman can attract a suitable man into her life by following her example. The sangskara, or sacred ceremony of marriage, sangskara is like sacrament, is called in Sanskrit vivaha. Vivaha. Vivaha means carrying one another. Is that nice? Carry one another. The traditional meaning is that the husband supports and cares for his wife while she upholds his position and prestige in the community and society. With women as much a part of the professional world as men nowadays, these notions have now become interchangeable. The sacred ceremony of marriage is meant to purify and strengthen the subtle bodies, that is, the emotional and mental bodies of the couple, so that they may become worthy and effective instruments in the hands of the divine. Also, that their marriage will uplift society and that they may produce children whose footsteps are a comfort to Mother Earth. In general, a man is the head and a woman is the heart. Men are intellectually oriented while women are emotionally oriented, generally speaking. The woman is the embodiment of love in the marriage and in family. She loves and is loved. She loves the children and thus kindles the vibrations of love in their hearts and minds. This binds them to her. The feminine loving vibration expands outward toward everyone and creates a similar vibration in the subtle bodies of others and other family members. It is the woman, and it is the role of the woman, that binds together the family members. And when her loving adhesive is missing in the home, then happiness and peace also cannot be found there. Simply put, love is a force that attracts things to itself. So therefore, a woman is a loving force that attracts things and people to itself. I like that paragraph. The concept behind marriage compatibility is finding two partners who will be suitable, what to speak of a perfect complement to each other, and that their union will thereby result in the improvement or the betterment of themselves and also of the human species. During sexual congress, there is an exchange of magnetic energy, and in some rare cases, spiritual energy. A perfect circuit of such energy is connected and completed between the bodies of the two participants, in the same way as an electrical current when two opposite poles come into contact with one another, positive and negative charge. The magnetic connection is there by virtue of the physical exchange. The presence of the spiritual connection is relative to the spiritual consciousness of the man and woman, and their invocation of God's grace and blessing in their loving reunion. If you're not thinking about God as part of your union, then no matter how loving it is, it's mundane. It has to be. If you bring the divine into your union, now we have a triangulation. God above and the two partners. But nonetheless, the energetic connection does take place on other levels in accordance with the various bodies that surround each person. In particular, the physical body, the emotional body, and the mental body. If a suitable marital match and compatibility of nature between the couple has been carefully determined, and due attention has been given to the grade, quality, and proportion of the male and female elements on the physical, emotional, ideological, mental, and spiritual levels, the couple should be blessed with health, harmony, and happiness. Their very union will strengthen their physical, emotional, and marital well-being. Won't it? It'll produce health. It'll produce happiness. It'll produce fruits of various kinds. Children may be one fruit, but there are many fruits that a marriage can produce. And with regard to the fruit of their marriage, it would also produce intelligent, fortunate, and long-lived children. The Vedic concept of marriage seeks to unite the head with the heart. The male typically represents the head, or intellectual discriminative energy, and the female typically represents the heart, emotional binding energy. In that sense, the man is the head of the family, and the woman is the heart of the family. So you say, I'm the head of the family. Of course you are, dear. I'm the heart. Rather than there being a power struggle. This isn't about a power struggle. This is about roles that are appropriate. It does not necessarily mean that he has to control all the family members, win all the arguments, and make all bend to his will. More properly, it means that he is to fulfill his discretionary or discriminative role in the context of the marriage and the disposition of the family. The woman's role as the pulsating heart is to motivate, inspire, intuit, and give voice to the feelings and desires of the family and its members. This is her function, and in this lies her power, in the act of binding all the family members together using her emotional mortar. Emotional mortar, ladies. I like that one. So, after the two are married, Shiva and Parvati depart to Mount Kailas, Shiva's favorite dwelling place, and immerse themselves in sexual dalliance, which continues uninterruptedly for long periods of time, apparently. Their lovemaking is so intense that it shakes the cosmos, and the gods again become frightened. Oh my God! The gods are always tail between the legs, and always worried. They're always worried about their position. They're like political parties, you know. They're like, Oh my God, where does it leave me? You know, what does this mean for me? They also then become afraid of what the child will be like, who is produced from the union of two such potent deities. They fear the child's extraordinary power. It is humorously ironic that the gods initially want to get Shiva to generate a child to neutralize the threat to their power by the demon Taraka. They then act to prevent the very thing they had set out to achieve when they believe it may prove an even greater threat to their political standing. It appears that politics is politics in whatever realm you find it. With this end in mind, the gods interrupt Shiva's and Parvati's lovemaking. Yes, coitus interruptus. Not such a good idea in this case. So, what happens here? As a result, Shiva spills his semen outside of Parvati. The potent seed is so fiery and hot that most containers are unable to accommodate it, and it burns right through. It finally ends up in the river Ganges, where it is incubated and born as the child, Kartikeya, the god of... Any guesses? War. The god of war. In North India, he's called Kartikeya. In South India, he is called Subramanyam. After defeating the demon Taraka in accordance with the prophecy and saving the world, Kartikeya finds his way back to his parents. So, the prophecy is realized. What to do when your husband is a mystic yogi and absorbs himself in meditation for days on end?
Lindsay, what do you
do? Ooh, I don't know what happened there.
She hyped you up.
Yeah. The modern day version of this is husbands who watch every sporting event broadcast on TV, or who play golf every chance they get. Or they are simply workaholics and never have time for the wife and family because of their perception of a greater responsibility to earn a good living for everybody. The flip side of that may be a deeper issue of avoidance and non-responsiveness in their relationships with their wife and family members. For most women, they would feel as if their husband is avoiding or neglecting them. The way Parvati handles this is to absorb herself in deep meditation and remove herself to the same subtle plane as Shiva, where she can be with him or communicate with him. That's what she does. Well, I'm going to go there too. And off she goes. And They're floating around out there doing their astral travel, whatever they're doing. And that's how she joins him. For those of us here on the physical plane, where we are, we can stay in contact with our loved one in a similar manner. Can you give me the Shiva Lingam? My office. For those of us here on the physical plane, we can stay in contact with our loved one in a similar manner on the astral plane in our astral body, consisting of mind, intellect, and ego, or simply through the medium of telepathy or the practice of empathy. Or we can simply remain on the mundane plane and learn how to appreciate sports. For this, it helps to learn the rules of the game that your husband loves to watch. Oh, that's a good idea. What's that? Yeah. Oh. I don't know that. That doesn't seem like that hard a rule. Transformation of libido into spiritual power is the art of conversion of energy or sexual alchemy. The house of love has two stories, the physical and the mystical. When energies are not exclusively operating on the lower level, the physical level, they rise up and nourish the higher plane. In the sexual practice of Tantra, a man never ejaculates his vital, precious semen, but actually tries to raise its essence up the spine to the brain. Its essence, not the semen itself, but the essence of it, the life force. Also called the soma chakra or third eye. You bring it up, yeah, because the most powerful creative physical substance in a male body is semen. It's the best of what the blood can produce. It produces life.
It's right? Kundalini energy, isn't it?
When it's transmuted, correct. Exactly. One who's able to master this attains higher states of consciousness and gains supernatural powers known as the eight mystic siddhis. Siddhi, S-I-D-D-H-I, not C-I-T-Y. This also enables the orgasm to be sustained much longer without the spilling of the precious liquid life force. The ultimate goal physiologically is to draw the vaginal fluid in through the penis and unite it with the seminal fluid. That's what they do. This creates an exalted state of consciousness or God consciousness through the union of the opposites, Prakriti, feminine, and Purusha, masculine, yin and yang. That's the tantric practice. Am I recommending this for everybody? Not necessarily. Parvati, as the primordial goddess, is known as Kundalini, the coiled one. The Kundalini is a symbol of dormant energy that must be uncoiled or unleashed. That is, raised up the spine, in order that its creative potency may be made manifest on the highest levels. Parvati is the volcano, the mountain that contains the fire. She takes the form of the vulva, which gives shelter or contentment to the phallus of fire represented by Shiva. Parvati establishes the phallic fire within her elements of earth and water. Otherwise, the phallus of fire has the power to reduce everything to ashes. Shiva is associated with fire, which dries or burns up the juices of life. His inner fire is so intense that in one story he is found to contain ashes in his veins instead of blood. So, this is a Shiva Lingam.
Phallus.
You go to a Shiva temple, that's what you see. It's worshipped throughout India. Creative potency. That's how you have to understand it. Don't understand it in some twisted way. It's the creative potency. Right? And what's this? That's the vulva. The vagina. And that's how it's represented. So that's Parvati. This must be contained or tamed by this. Cool, huh? Mm-hmm. And then we'll get this. The coiled one, the serpent, rising up.
Amazing.
Hmm?
Yeah, that's
pretty. This is silver. Got this from Fumi. Brought it from India. There's even some eyes painted on the lingam. In another story, Shiva becomes so furious with the god of love, Kama or Cupid, for disturbing his meditation that he reduces him to ashes with fire shot out from his third eye. Parvati, on the other hand, is associated with water, Soma in particular. Soma is the life-giving essence found in all plants, essentially their juice. It is also the elixir of immortality that the gods and demons churned from the ocean of milk. She prevails upon Shiva to revive Kama, that is to regenerate the power of sex desire. Now, there's an interesting statement here that says Shiva is associated with fire which dries up or burns the juices of life. What happens when you get real old? You shrivel. You become skeletal. Right? Skin and bone. Well, I don't wish that on any of you, but it's the life force. You know, they make certain jokes about men masturbating and having too much sex, and their eyesight will go. And you know, I've been wearing these since I was 7, so there's no proof there. Your health will break down, and this is true. If there's too much of a spilling of semen, it will weaken the constitution, and it will reduce the life force. It's the quickest way to kill off a husband. Just make him have sex with you all the time, regularly. He'll be gone in no time. This is not a sexual story, but it's kind of a funny story. Sort of sad but true. I had this client years ago in Los Angeles, and she was in her early, she was around about 50 at the time, and she had married a man much, much older than she. So he was probably around 70. And he was extremely wealthy. They lived in Hancock Park in Los Angeles, which is a really, really exclusive neighborhood with old, old, huge homes, you know, like big Victorian mansions, but huge, you know, gated community. And she was coming to see me for astrological consultation. And she had me look at her chart. Then she had me look at his chart. So when's he going to die? When's he going to die off? I said, well, is he ill or something? Well, no. Well, then why are you worried about him dying? I'm not worried about him dying. I'm just wondering when he's going to die. So, clearly, you know. Die already, you know. So I can... Because my daughter, the daughter from the previous marriage, and I, we need to get our hands on some of that money. And we just can't, you know. And so I'd seen her, I guess, over a period of a couple of years. No. This lady had been a flight attendant. And she met her husband in first class on the airplane. She was working. So one of the people that was connected to her, who was also one of my clients, you know, two years past, something like that. And it might have been 4 years since I first met her. So let's say she was around now, about 54 or something, 55. I said, how's so-and-so doing? I can't remember her name now. Oh, didn't you hear? I said, no. Well, she died of breast cancer. I said, you're kidding. She did? Yes. It spread very quickly. And before you knew it, she was gone. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. And what about her husband, you know? Oh, yeah, no, he's in good form. He's doing fine. He's golfing every day. You're not a bother him. Yeah, exactly, you know. It's already backfired.
She was focusing on death so much. You know, could it be?
Yeah. Well, who knows, you know. Yeah, I mean, you know, you can entertain disease with your emotions and your mind. We all know that. In our society, maleness, or machismo, is measured by a man's ability to get it up. How many times he's able to get it up, and how many partners he has gotten it up with. Shiva demonstrates that one's spiritual strength, conviction, and commitment are measured by one's disinterest in getting it up. But rather, it is gauged by one's determination to keep it down. Sex desire is the root cause and the sustaining factor of household and family life. Overcoming sex desire ultimately leads the soul to liberation from repeated birth, old age, disease, and death. If a man cannot sustain this path while young, it's hard when you're young, then he must practice it in his latter years. All right. So, I think we'll leave it there. Any questions, comments?
No friends in here.
Oh, there's... No, no. You see, this is for men. Women can have as much sex as they want. It doesn't have a negative effect on women. It does, though. A lot of sex will create a vata imbalance, ayurvedically. It will unground you. Mm-hmm. So that's not good, but it has a much greater deleterious effect on men than it does on women. But not so much the sex, the spilling of the semen, of the vital force. See, women's orgasm is internal. Nothing's technically spilled. But men, it's the opposite. And that's just it. In our society, hey, you know, yeah. So did you, you know, score last night?
Yeah.
How'd you do? You know? And the more sex you have with more partners, the more of a man you're considered to be. Well, this is, it's just all part of the illusion. It's an illusion. And the sooner you'll toddle off to the cemetery.
I can't understand why, why I feel really annoyed and angry when I was with, I remember I was with a partner for like a period of time, and I it would just come out anger in me every time seeing this spilled sort of. And I couldn't understand, I actually thought I was going crazy, because I was going, oh, I'm meant to be enjoying this, but I'm not. So how...
Wasn't that between you and he, though? Wasn't that... You
yeah, but I don't understand why a woman would produce that.
Well, I don't either, exactly, because that's not usually the case. Unless
it's
that
picking up on the energy.
Yeah, unless it's an energy. You see, the other thing we've talked about this here is there's an energetic deposit that's being made, and or a physical deposit, and that stays in the cellular matrix of the female for who knows how long to come. And I mean, that's why if you don't respect a person and don't really want his energies hanging around your cellular matrix, what are you doing with them to begin with, is the question. You know, you must be careful.
But it's not promoting abstinence there as such. You know, obviously
abstinence is not for most people,
yeah.
Not for most men, and even the priesthood in India, they're all married.
Mm-hmm.
They're all married. It's promoting monogamy.
Yeah.
One partner.
Moderation. Yeah.
It actually says in the Vedas, sex once a month.
It's almost like we're clearly the same, but the mantra is just a little bit of investment there, saving up, not just throwing it all away every opportunity.
Well, the more you save it up and the more you contain it, the more potent it becomes, and the more it the more strength it gives you, and the more benefit it's going to have for you and your family overall, you know. And then when it is used for the purpose for which it is meant, then it really has the ability to produce some powerful beings.
Certainly in Western society, for men of certain ages anyway, once a month would seem to be very extreme, you know, for young men anyway.
Not enough yet.
But it's quite close to abstinence in many ways. But certainly.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
Close to, like, almost a penance.
Well, especially in this society, for example, where anytime you open a newspaper or a magazine, you see half-naked, beautiful women, tantalizing you, and
everything in traffic a lot.
How would you handle children if you I'm just trying to work it out logically and think, like, if people are only having sex once a month, there'd be no children.
Why? You just have it when you're ovulating.
You want to be spot on, though.
Well, my dear, you only ovulate once a month, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, then. So what do you mean? You ovulate for 2 to 3 days a month. So you can have sex all the rest of those days. You won't get pregnant no matter how hard you try. So what is the question?
Yeah.
Right?
Going back to the point of it being a more spiritual experience, is there anything that you'd... Like, is there, say, for instance, a mantra that you'd...
In what sense, Colette?
It's just, if you want to bring it to that level.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, many of the mantras that we've already given you could work with to bring it to a more spiritual level. The idea is to invoke God and invoke the presence of God. Especially if you are directly trying to conceive a child, that's exactly what you want to do. You know, because even the sex act in that sense would be an offering. It would be an offering to God.
Yeah.
That's what you'd want it to be. You know.
Well, there isn't one mantra.
Not a particular mantra. I mean, there are mantras, but I can't think of one particular mantra that... Excuse me. Well, let me think. There is one.
It all kind of goes back to the intention, doesn't it, really?
Always.
Yeah.
It's heading towards self-awareness no matter what. I don't think that, you know, whatever act, whether it's sex or whether it's eating or praying or whatever, that
well, yeah,
becoming more aware of.
You know, our attitude oftentimes is, well, I enjoy eating. Let me eat more.
Yeah.
Let me eat too much.
Yeah.
You know, here's a big dinner.
Let's go for it.
Let me eat two plates instead of one, or let me eat three plates if I can.
Yeah.
You know, let me if I can do, I may as well overdo. You know. Yeah, I can comfortably drink one or two pints, but I'm going to have six. Why don't you just have two? You know?
Well, it's just as you're saying that, I'm wondering, equating the whole thing, like the drinking culture here and the high sex needs, if you like, or whatever, I'm just wondering, is part of it because, you know, in some ways there isn't an awareness nearly of what you're doing on some level.
There is no awareness. There is no awareness.
So it never gets really satisfied on some level.
Well, there is, according to the Vedic understanding, as we said many times, there's no real satisfaction in any kind of material activity. There's momentary satisfaction. You can't tell me I didn't enjoy eating my piece of cake, that she didn't enjoy having sex. But correct. But here in the material world, we have the law of satiation. No matter what it is, no matter how much you enjoy it, if you keep doing it over and over and over again, no, I can't take it anymore. I can't. You can't eat. You can only eat so much. Even if you had sex for 8 hours, if at some point you're going to go, I can't take it anymore. No more. It's not pleasing any longer. Anything like that. There's a law of satiation. In the spiritual world, there's no law of satiation. There is no limit to things because they're spiritual in nature. They're ever increasing. They're ever fresh. But here, it's different. And what it's doing in many of these cases, when you overdo drink, drugs, sex, eating, you're actually harming yourself. You're actually reducing your life. You're not enhancing your life. You can say, yeah, well, wait a second. It's all nonsense. I enhance my pleasure. I don't care what you say. Yeah, okay. I don't know how anybody who's stumbling around, falling on the floor, is blind drunk, is enhancing his pleasure. Because looking at him, he's not enhancing my pleasure. But he thinks, hey, I had such a great time last night. What did you do? I can't for the life of me remember. You know. So, anyway. I'm not so much judging people like that because, you know, I had my day too. You go through what you go through and you learn what you have to learn. But if you don't have to drag yourself through some of these extreme kinds of experiences, you can save yourself that. Well, there's more, but we will leave it there because I have to do this mantra because I want to do it today. A few more minutes here. As I said, this is a Vedic mantra. And there we have our Brahmins sitting on either side of the sacred fire doing the fire yajna, fire sacrifice. The translation, this is something you really might want to chant, you know, on a regular basis. We worship and pray to the Supreme Lord for the welfare of all beings. May all miseries and shortcomings leave us forever, so that we may always sing for the Lord during the sacred fire ceremonies. May all medicinal herbs grow in potency, so that all diseases may be cured. May the gods rain peace upon us. May all the two-legged creatures be happy. And may all the four-legged creatures also be happy. May there be peace in the hearts of all beings in all realms. Om, peace, peace, peace. Lovely, huh? Okay.
Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om Tacham Yora Vani Mahe Gatum.
See where we are?
Gatum Yajna Padaye Daivi Swasti Rastunaha Swasti Manu Shephyaha Vodhram Jigatu Bhesajam Sem no astvat vipare, sem chatushpare, om shanti shanti shanti.
You ready? Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om Satyam Yoravranimahe Gatum Yajnaya Gatum Yajnapataye Daivi Svastirastunaha Svastir Manushevyaha Urdvam Jagatu Beshajam Shamno Astu Dripade Sham Chatushpade Om Shanti 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 Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om Tacham yor avranimahe Gatum yagyaya Gatum yagyapataye Daivi swastirastunaha Swastir manushevyaha Urdvam jagatu beshajam Shamno astu dvipade Sham chatushpade Om Shanti 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 Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om Tacham Yoravranimahe Gatum Yajnaya Gatum Yajnapataye Daivi Swastirastunaha Swastir Manushevyaha Urdvam Jagatu Beshajam Shamno Astu Dvipade Sham Chatushpade Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Beautiful.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Now, Kalindi's already downloaded this onto my website under podcasts. It's the one way at the bottom. It's the very bottom. And it says Peace Invocation Mantra. So you can actually listen to it because, you know, I mean, this is a... I usually give you a pretty simple mantra, but this one's pretty involved. But it's really, really nice, and it's a beautiful sentiment. And it would be nice to learn it off, you know. All right, so I think we're going to leave it there this evening because we got kind of a late start. And thank you for coming.
Peter.
Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om Tat Sat, Jai Shri Krishna.